Welcome to WMKV Health Scope, a weekly discussion of health and wellness issues for older adults, their families, and caregivers. This call-in program is presented by 89.3 WMKV. To have your medical-related question concerning today's topic answered live on the air, call 513-772-9658. That's 772-WMKV. And now, WMKV Health Scope.
Well, hello and welcome. And I'm Mike Martini, sitting in for George Zahn today on Health Scope. And while it would be inaccurate to call the brain and its functions a total mystery, science and medicine still agree there's a lot to learn about how our brains work and how it controls everything we as living creatures do. At the UC Neuroscience Institute, research is ongoing, and joining us today to talk about some of the latest advancements is Dr. James Herman. Dr. Herman is the director of the Network of Neuroscience Discovery, as well as a professor of psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at UC. And Dr. Herman, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Mike.
And maybe we can begin with a little bit of a definition about neuroscience. I guess to be simplistic, as opposed to, say, pulmonology or cardiology, it's the study of impulses and the brain and how everything kind of interconnects in the person's body.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. So basically, neuroscience is the study of the brain and spinal cord. And it's kind of an interesting field of endeavor because a lot of times when you're thinking about types of scientific endeavors, you're thinking about things that are very specific, biochemistry, physiology, anatomy. Neuroscience really is a field of study that combines all of these things in an attempt to find out how it is the brain works. And the combinations really are needed because you can't understand what the brain is doing physiologically without understanding its biochemistry. And you can't understand diseases of the brain until you understand the basic principles that are underlying a lot of the processes that are involved. So it's an interesting and it's a very interdisciplinary field of study.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I guess in some things, in some sciences, it's, you know, just the hardware side of it, the impulses, electrical impulses and nerves and things like that. But as you said, you're mixing in how humans develop and the interconnectedness of personalities and emotions and things like that. Does it all come under the term then mental health in some way or another?
Well, mental health and also neurological health, right? So you also have diseases that are associated with problems with nerves, problems with parts of the brain, things along those lines that, you know, are not necessarily only mental health. But, you know, the neuroscience really does span the gamut from genes all the way up to psychology. So people who are basic geneticists can call themselves neuroscientists, and people who are actually looking at real problems in people in terms of mental illness are also neuroscientists.
So is it accurate to say that we're still have a lot to learn when it comes to this area, and especially brain function and how things work?
Oh, yeah, I think that's accurate. I think some of us consider that job security also.
Before we talk about some specific things, how did you originally get interested in this in these sciences? And was there something in your life or your education that said, hey, this is really fascinating?
Yeah, actually, I had been wandering around as an undergraduate in my college in upstate New York for kind of a number of years and trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I took a course called physiological psychology, which is now what we would call behavioral neuroscience. And that really kind of blew me away, that the notion that we can actually make efforts to understand how it is that the brain actually works. And it's such an interesting and such a really kind of a cool problem to explore.
I guess it's really one of the oldest questions that humans have. I mean, back to the time of the Greeks, and a lot of the philosophers had questions based upon the issues that you raise, I'm sure, in your research, just how the things connect and how we think and how we are who we are.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The I think the question of, Descartes' mind-body problem is still being debated amongst neuroscientists today. So we do have a lot to learn, but it's really a very fascinating and fun field of endeavor.
So tell us about the UC Neuroscience Institute. Now, this is a division of the overall UC Health
The Neuroscience Institute is really kind of the clinical arm of neuroscience at the university. And so it involves a tripartite effort that includes arranging for clinical delivery to patients. And this includes patients with diseases varying from multiple sclerosis to Parkinson's disease to mood disorders, bipolar disorder, depression, et cetera. But it's also geared toward making the next advances in research, and that really is where how I came to be involved with UCNI, is to kind of make these bridges where we can use what we're doing in the laboratory in the very basic sciences to kind of understand what the disease processes are and how we can help patients down the road with new discoveries. So that is kind of where the Network for Neuroscience Discovery fits in, with being able to kind of make a link between the research angle and the clinical delivery.
Yeah, maybe you could talk a little about the network, because I guess this is kind of a new thought process, right, to include different disciplines in trying to come up with solutions and things like that?
Yeah, the network has been in effect since about 2010, and the notion is to bring together what we are doing in the laboratory to assist and kind of inform what people are doing in clinical research and in the clinic through the UCNI. And it's also an effort to bring together the educational programs in neuroscience. For example, the undergraduate neuroscience major at the College of Arts and Sciences at UC and the neuroscience graduate program in the College of Medicine. And by bringing together the clinical arm, the educational arm, and the research arm, we stand to be better integrated and better positioned to really make headway in areas where we have particular areas of expertise and particular critical mass.
Surprised it hasn't been done before. I mean, although I know, at times there's different turfs and things like that, but...
Yeah.
It's good that it's finally happened. But
well, neuroscience is an interesting endeavor because, as I mentioned earlier, you're taking anatomy, physiology, and trying to meld all these things into one integrated area of research. And if you think about what's going on, for example, at the College of Arts and Sciences and the Department of Psychology, they are going to have a very human intervention area of emphasis, and then you have the basic researchers in the lab, like myself, that are doing preclinical work in animal models. And so it seems like this is something that would have been done a long time ago, but in a lot of ways it's hard to kind of get all these people together in the same room, and that really is what you need to do to make the next big discovery. I think science today, more than it ever has been, is a team sport, and you really have to have the folks that are doing all of the angles together to talk. And it really, that's where the richness comes in. That you have, for example, from my own experience, being able to, I came here from the University of Kentucky in 2000, and being able to talk with my psychiatric colleagues about people that actually have the diseases that I'm studying has really kind of revolutionized the way I approach my science. So I have gotten much more interested in looking at models that have particular relevance to the disease, and actually even developing models that are improved, have improved relevance, so we can get a little more at the underlying processes. And also in terms of the education, bringing up, offering our undergraduate students the ability to study neuroscience. That has only been ongoing. I think the neuroscience major is now in its fourth year. And it started off, I was in on the foundation of the undergraduate neuroscience major, and it started off with an estimate of having about 30 students a year. It now has about 250.
Wow, that's great.
And so it shows that there's interest in the brain with our students. Certainly there's interest in the brain with our graduate students and medical students and fellows. And so, you know, it's actually a very exciting time at the university to see these efforts coming together and having people in the same room talking that really offer a lot of diversity to the scientific emphasis moving forward.
That's great. Do you also find, in kind of an overall picture, institutions being more willing to share information? You say you came from UK, mm-hmm. Different research departments at various higher learning institutes around the country. I mean, are they sharing more, or is it still something that everything's kind of in house now? You don't really need to.
No, that's actually a very good point, and that's something that the notion of neuroscience being a team sport that extends beyond university boundaries. Also, locally, we have very rich collaborations with the Children's Hospital Research Unit. We also have very rich collaborations with other institutions in Southwest Ohio, such as Miami University, University of Dayton, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. And most of the people that are doing basic science research have outside collaborations. Like all places, University of Cincinnati can't be everything, and we don't have every single bit of research expertise that we need. And what one has to do now in this climate is to go outside and really be able to form relationships with folks at other institutions that do what you can't do here.
Very good.
So, for example, my group has collaborations with people at the University of Michigan, with people at Tulane University to work on the same problem together from different points of view.
Great. You're listening to HealthScope. I'm Mike Martini. Our topic today is research in the brain, neuroscience, and our guest today is Dr. Jim Herman. And I know some of your research in the past has dealt with issues related to depression, and here we are on a Monday in January. It's kind of cloudy, and I know most people feel varying degrees of depression at times, particularly in these gray, mm-hmm. winter weary months.
Right.
First of all, from your aspect as a researcher, what is depression? What is it? It's not something. I mean, there's some physiological things going on. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I think the better way to phrase that might be, what are depressions? That there's I think what we found out in over the last several years is that there are actually multiple diseases with multiple causes. Most of the causes will have some component of genetic risk, but also a lot of environmental risk. And the way depression occurs is very personalized. That there's a lot of differences between individuals, and there are parts of individuals, such as their past experience, their early life experience, exposures to trauma and so on, that may make different people more susceptible to having the disorder versus others that might be more resilient.
Yeah, I get sometimes, feelings of I would say slight depression, and I'm a big Lincolnophile, Abraham mm-hmm. Lincoln. They say that he suffered from melancholia.
Right.
So I would assume that's one of those areas of depression that's not severe, but kind of the blues. People
right.
get the blues.
Mm-hmm.
So basically your research has shown that these different areas of depression are based on severity, or is there more to it than just saying, well, I'm a little more depressed today than I was yesterday? Or,
well, I think there's always natural variations in mood, and those variations occur in all of us. It's really when the individual gets in such a cycle of gets to the point where they can't recover, they can't cycle out of the negative mood, that it becomes intrusive and becomes what we normally characterize as the disorder of depression. So a little bit of depression is always normal, right? So you have your, everybody has their ups and downs. It's when you can't get out of the downs, when you can't get out of the doldrums, that it becomes particularly problematic.
Very interesting. Now, we do have a phone call, so we have some more to ask about that. But let's go ahead and talk to Alan real quick here. By the way, our number is 772-9658 in Cincinnati, 877-772-9658, toll-free. And Alan, welcome to HealthScope.
Hi,
Hello,
Alan.
Good afternoon. Yes. Dr. Herman.
Yes.
I'm wondering if the effect of electromagnetic sources on people is at all recognized, and if it's recognized, is it at all understood by the medical community?
So that's a very good question. So the are you referring to the electromagnetic radiations, for example, from power lines and things along those lines?
Well, it could be power lines, but this is something that I recognized in myself over 10 years ago. And for example, before I even knew I had it, I picked up a flashlight, for example, just a small flashlight, probably running on AA batteries, and immediately my tongue was singed. Hmm. You could look at it and see the singe marks on the tip of my tongue. This has happened with some computers, sitting at a computer, and all many other types of electromagnetic sources, even fluorescent lighting. So I'm really at a loss to know what, if anything, to do about it.
Hmm. Yeah, that is a tough one. I can't say that I'm familiar with a lot of cases that have indicated, your type of issues. In general, the whole notion of electromagnetic radiations, for example, from power lines, that's very controversial as to whether there's a generalized effect of those on folks. And there are therapies, actually, that use electromagnetic stimulation, transcranial stimulation, that have had some benefit in treating, for example, some disorders. So clearly, electromagnetic radiation can have effects on the brain, but whether they can be, whether it's a generalized phenomenon that goes across everyone is kind of, that's a problem that still needs to be solved.
Yeah, maybe you can contact your primary care physician and explain it to that person, or I guess the bottom line is that it's possible, and maybe there is someone out there you can speak to about that, Alan.
Right. Thank you.
All right, Alan.
Thank
thanks you. For your call. Our number again is 772-9658 or 877-772-9658. And we were talking a bit about depression with Dr. Herman here. And there is an underlying sort of a chemical, in some cases, a chemical imbalance at play here?
Correct. There's a number of different hypotheses. And some hypotheses, for example, there are molecules in the brain that control growth and vitality of neurons. For example, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And one of the hypotheses is that life experiences, for example, the types of experience that I study, chronic stress, actually result in a loss of this very critical compound that kind of maintains the neural circuits together and talking to one another the way that they're supposed to. And by reducing the expression of this molecule, you kind of lose some connections. And so you lose the connection that is able to allow you to appropriately deal with the meaning of incoming information. So one example is a clinical example in the literature that one of the things that folks with depression, when you look by functional magnetic resonance imaging, for example, at the functional activity of their brain, if you show an individual with the depression a series of faces, from smiling to neutral to angry, the individuals with depression will attribute the neutral faces to being negative emotionality, and their brains will also register a difference in activity that corresponds with that interpretation. So it's almost as if something has happened in the brain that has changed how you look at the world, that you're now looking at the world from a more negative point of view, and this is probably due to changes in the brain that are associated with the individual neurocircuits and how they're connected with one another.
Now, the we hear, especially this time of year, seasonal affective disorder.
Right.
This is kind of a long story here, but I had a friend a long time ago who took herbal things like St. John's wort.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, that's kind of silly. And then my wife and I, we have a 70-acre property out in Indiana, and there's some wild St. John's wort growing out there. Mm-hmm. And so I talked to an elderly farmer neighbor, and he said, yeah, you can't let the cows and the horses eat that because they'll get sunburned, and you have to keep them in the barn for a few days. And so I guess there are chemicals that can make you more sensitive to light, and I guess is it the light then that induces some sort of chemical balance in your body that affects your mood and things like that?
Well, yeah, that is definitely true, right? So the light is really the important component of this. And so there's a part of the brain that is very sensitive to day length. And this part of the brain is also very much interconnected with the circuits of the brain that are involved in regulating mood. And so once again, it's going to be different in different people. Some people are going to be susceptible to the changes in day length more so than others. But the way the so-called pineal gland, which is a area of the brain that's kind of located right in the midline, it was actually what Descartes called the seat of the soul. He didn't know neuroanatomy back in the good old days, if you will. But the pineal gland is actually very important in processing this type of light information. And so seasonal affective disorder is a very real thing. And once again, it's kind of very individualized. It's who is susceptible and how is it they're susceptible and what's kind of gauging that vulnerability.
I can't help but think that there's some very basic part of us that dates back to the caveman era where, you know, days got shorter and days got longer and how important, you know, that sort of thing was to them. And maybe that's a very primal thing to us. But and I'm not saying, you know, St. John's wort or any type of medicine, you know, obviously you should speak to someone, maybe a physician or something or an expert before you try something like that. But there are perhaps ways that you can help if is a severe case that that you can help balance those chemicals. Inside.
Right. Yeah. And that's actually one of the notions of pharmacotherapy that serotonin and norepinephrine and other neurotransmitters in the brain are actually disrupted in depression. And these drugs, such as fluoxetine, amitriptyline, imipramine, so on, these drugs that folks take are prescribed by physicians, are actually good at correcting those neurochemical imbalances. But what's very interesting is they only work in a subset of individuals. So a lot of the therapies don't work for everybody, and that's the big challenge. That's why the notion that these are multiple diseases with multiple causes and multiple ways to treat them is important to consider moving forward.
Our number is 772-9658 or 877-772-9658 if you have a question about neuroscience and some of the research going on. Feel free to give us a call, 772-9658. You mentioned one of the tools that you use, and I kind of jotted this down, so I might have this wrong, but functional resonance imaging, is this a way for you to kind of blueprint or map out the brain as different parts function?
Yeah, functional magnetic resonance imaging.
Okay.
And so that is basically a imaging procedure that gets a look at blood flow in the brain. And so by looking at blood flow, you can get an estimate of how active or inactive those brain regions are. One of the very interesting things, one of the new therapies that's being used, not to some extent at UC, but in wider clinical trials elsewhere, is actually the notion of deep brain stimulation. And so there's an area of the brain called, this will be a big phrase, the subgenual anterior cingulate cortex, or Area 25, okay, as they call it, Brodmann's Area 25 of the brain, that shows a marked increase in activity in individuals that are depressed. And when people go in, and so this is by imaging, right? So you're looking at blood flow, and you can see that this area has a higher blood flow in individuals that are depressed. And if you give an individual, for example, successful antidepressant treatment, that overactivity will decrease. And interestingly, if you insert a small electrode into this region of the brain and stimulate, you will also decrease the activity. That sounds counterintuitive, but there's a physiological explanation for why you would can stimulate and actually decrease activity. It has to do with kind of how it is the neurons respond to the impulses that they're receiving. But this treatment is actually able to significantly reverse depressive symptoms in a good proportion of the patients that it's been tried in. And this is work that's been really championed down at Emory University by Helen Mayberg. And actually, in the lab, one of the things that we're trying to do is understand what the biology of this area of the brain is and why it is that the this seems to be a real focal zone for understanding depression, pathology, etc. Our work actually uses animal models to look at these types of things. And the animal models afford you the ability to go in and really understand what are the molecular and chemical and really physical properties that are causing these changes that are manifest as problems associated with mood.
You said Area 25. You know, when you're really young, you learn that it's just one brain and that's your computer. And then you get a little older in high school, it's like, well, you got the right half and the left half. One is for art and one is for logic and that.
Yep.
But how many really areas, how many can science pinpoint that do specific functions?
Oh, lots.
Really?
So there's evidence for areas that are right, for example, right next to this area 25, which is called kind of the prelimbic cortex. And this prelimbic cortex is actually important in interpretation of pleasure. And so obviously one of the problems associated with depression is that individuals really don't find things pleasurable. And this area of the brain being right next to the area that seems to be driving the core mood symptoms, you know, gives you the notion that, well, hey, maybe there's these two regions talk to each other, and maybe there's crosstalk between these two, and maybe why you have the reduction in pleasure and the reduction in mood commonly go together. And then the area just above that is very important in interpretation of pain. And is an area of the brain that was targeted and to some extent still is targeted as a means of interfering with intractable pain. So there's a lot of compartmentalization in the brain that goes on, and it goes on all across the brain. There's an old saying that we only use 10% of our brain.
Right, right.
Well, you know, I really don't think I want to meet anybody that only uses 10% of their brain, because for most of the time we're using all of it. Mm-hmm. And even when we're sleeping, you know, the brain is very active. So that old notion that there's a lot of reserve capacity, et cetera, you know, that's not necessarily the case. There's a lot of redundancy, but it doesn't mean that things aren't always talking to each other.
That's fascinating. So when you have your animal subjects and you do mm-hmm. some of the research, are their brains complex enough to have these same Area 25 and Area 26 and things like that, or do you have to extrapolate the fact that, you know, maybe these are less developed as human brains?
Well, they're every bit as, in some sense, they're every bit as developed, right?
Really?
So the rats and mice have been around since the prehistoric age. We've only been around for, you know, a couple of maybe a million years or so. So they've had a lot more shot at kind of evolving these things than we do. But the brains are smaller, but they're still kind of organized by the same compartmentalization. So the same problems that we have to solve, survival, eating, reproducing, sleeping, drinking, affiliation, you know, relationships, things like that, social behaviors, those animals also have those problems to solve, and they need to solve them in a different way, but they will still have the same areas of the brain doing approximately the same analogous types of functions. So it's surprising, and actually one of the things that's notable about depression is that it is really linked very intimately to what we consider to be stress pathways in the brain. So this area 25 I was talking about and other areas of the brain that are very important are actually areas that control how we perceive and how we react to stress. And that's a problem that all organisms have to solve. We have to be able to efficiently deal with stress. And if we don't deal with that efficiently, it causes significant problems down the road in terms of our ability to even survive. So these areas are analogous, and I mean, they solve problems in different ways. If you look at the rodent brain, it's the part of its brain that's associated with the nose is tremendously overgrown compared to ours, but it has a very small visual region, and our visual region is very, very large, and our region that's devoted to smell is extremely small, and it's because we're more worried about how it is that we're going to be able to, well, I guess the swing from trees, if you will. You have to have good vision,
right,
and be able to have visual spatial coordination. And the rodents are more geared toward, you know, well, do I smell a predator or do I smell food or how that goes? I mean, they're nocturnal. They don't use their vision a whole lot. So every organism solves things in different ways. But the mammalian brain is very highly, highly conserved.
Very interesting. This is a great topic. We have a great guest today, Dr. Jim Herman, and he's the director of a Network of Neuroscience Discovery and also at UC Neuroscience Institute. And we're going to be back right after this brief break. And if you have any questions, please give us a call back after this.
The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program or of WMKV Radio, Maple Knoll Communities, or its staff and management. Discussion of specific points and general topics on this program are not to be taken as specific professional advice.
And welcome back. This is HealthScope. I'm Mike Martini. Our guest today is Dr. Jim Herman, and he's the director of the Network of Neuroscience Discovery. He is also professor of psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at UC Neuroscience Institute. And we're talking today about some of the research, some of the topics that are underway right now as far as the study of the brain, depression. We have some other topics to discuss in a little bit as well. I do have a few more questions about depression, but before we do that, let's talk to Bill real quick. Hi, Bill.
I have a question about how the brain processes time.
Ooh, time.
It seems like, now that I'm older, when I was younger, time would go by a lot slower. And now that I'm older, it seems like time goes by quicker.
Well,
and I've heard that from a lot of other people that are aging.
Oh,
Is there part of the brain that processes time?
Well, Bill, I can tell you that I've wondered about that on numerous occasions. I'm 55, and boy, it just seems like time is going by faster and faster every day. There are areas of the brain that process time. A lot of those areas are involved in our kind of linkage between the emotional and cognitive behaviors and the so-called day-to-day rhythms, you know, day-night rhythms, hormone secretory rhythms, etc. And so there are areas that process time, but how it is that the perception of time changes, we really don't have a handle on that. I wish we did, because I would really like to figure out how to make it go a little more slowly, if you will.
That'll give you something to work on.
It will give me something to work on, yes. Thank you, Bill.
Okay.
All right, Bill, thanks for your call. Again, our number is 772-9658 or 877-772-9658. And that's kind of an interesting point in that, you know, how time speeds up as we get older. I wonder, and looking back at research, issues like depression, is it more prevalent now than it was, say, 100 years ago or 200 years ago? And is that, you mentioned stress before, is that perhaps a factor if it is more prevalent now? Or was it just not diagnosed back then?
Yeah, that's a big question, because the diagnosis really is a relatively new thing. It's only been within probably the last 50 to 60 years or so that people kind of recognize this as a disease and not kind of a natural progression of life. And like, for example, there was, when I first got into the research game, there was something called postmenopausal melancholia that was kind of linked as being a consequence of being menopausal and not really a depressive disease. And we now know that that is as much depression as is the spontaneous depression that might erupt in somebody that's in their 20s, for example. So it has changed over the it has changed. You would say it's increased in prevalence, but you don't really know because of how, you know, poor the diagnosis was, and also how society actually viewed the diagnosis. You know, is it sometimes the answer to people with depression was, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and you can't. That's not something that someone who has severe depression is capable of doing, you know, kind of thinking themselves out of it. So it's a tough question. We don't really know. If you look kind of in the historical record, and a lot of people have gone back and made surmisals on who might have been depressed or whatnot. You mentioned Abraham Lincoln earlier, Ernest Hemingway, Julius Caesar, you know, all these folks. Robert Schumann also, the great composer, supposedly had depressive episodes, but you can't diagnose them because you don't able to see them with today's tests. So my guess is it's always been with us, and it probably has something to do, as I said, with these systems of the brain that process stress, and just kind of having the wrong set of circumstances intervene to kind of bring you into this state. There's a theory out there that a lot of what happens with diseases such as depression is that they are essentially a remnant of the sickness behavior. That in effect, what we do when we're sick, you know what you feel like if you have the flu or something like that, you're going to be sleeping, not eating, and keeping to yourself. And part of the reason for doing that is, what do you do when you're sick and out in the wild? You don't want to be, you're slow and not as sharp as you want to be, so you don't want to be wandering around where you can get picked off by a predator. And if your disorder was associated with eating, you don't want to be eating more food, and you need the rest to be able to fight off the viruses, et cetera. So it's not a lot of that. It might even be kind of a remnant of this type of disorder, and just kind of click in at the wrong time, if you will, in terms of the changes in the mood.
You mentioned, you know, Hemingway and that, but it's not necessarily, say, a right brain, an artistic person, or a more logical person. I mean, really, there's no trend. Now, you did mention something earlier when we first went on the air. By the way, our number is 772-9658 here in Cincinnati, about genetics. Can genetics be a factor in depression?
Yes, there are numerous. Depression does run in families. It's not as tightly linked to genetics, say, as schizophrenia, but it is. And there are a number of of what they call SNPs in the human genome that can be directly linked to depressed individuals, then indicate that there might be a change in the DNA structure, in other words, an inherited change that could predispose folks to depression. And even in those cases, there are thoughts that you kind of need two hits, that just having the gene change alone isn't enough to make you depressed. You also need to have an adverse experience somewhere along the line, a significant life stressor that kind of mixes with that genetic predispositions and puts folks over into the disease state.
I saw I forget what national news source it was online, but they had some pretty pictures of these helmets, anti-depression helmets. And I guess we were talking before, you were saying about electromagnetic things like that.
Transcranial stimulation.
Right, it looks like something out of that George Jetson would wear, this big round helmet.
Yeah.
But, I guess you could try to control it that way or through the medicines that I see advertisements on commercials on TV. It's the long list of side effects. It's almost like, well, that alone would make you depressed just thinking about potential side effects.
But the drugs do work. Mm-hmm. They don't work for everybody, but for a substantial population, they do. And it's interesting because a lot of times they take a while to kick in. And it's thought that the reason, and once again, this is work kind of that comes from the lab and has been kind of used to help understand the disease, which is something that, you know, we've been working on with the network relationships with UCNI here at UC. But they found that this delay might very well be the fact that you have to change expression of crucial molecules in the brain to a level. So once again, it is associated with this BDNF molecule, brain-derived neurotrophic molecule that I was mentioning earlier, that this seems to be turned down in individuals with depression, and it takes a couple of weeks for the expression of this protein to get ramped up to where it's now back to so-called normal levels. And it's thought that the reason why a lot of these drugs take a while to kick in is exactly this, that you need to your brain needs time to kind of replenish the things that have been lost by kind of the disconnection of the circuits.
So as a researcher, where is research now? Is it more toward the medicine side? Is it more toward the electromagnetic helmets, or are there a combination? I mean, is it balanced 50-50, or are there other areas that, as far as depression is concerned, that science and research is looking at fixes?
Yeah, I think it's. I think you're talking. There's multiple ways to go about this. I think one of the most fundamental components of the research that's ongoing is trying to understand what the pathology is, and that is doing basic studies in animal models or even in some cases in cell cultures, things along those lines. Try to understand what are the things that are happening to the chemical balance in these brain regions that are critical for mood. And does that give us any clues as to where to go next in terms of treatments, you know, new drug interventions and so on? The second line really is looking at pharmaceutical development of new compounds that can be used either alone or in combination with others to afford a better benefit for people. And then the transcranial magnetic stimulation, also vagal stimulation a few years ago was in vogue. There are a number of kind of device associated ways to kind of deep brain stimulation also to kind of jumpstart, if you will, the brain in order to get things back. And so there's active areas of research ongoing in all of those. I think one of the important things to consider, and this is an area of research that has really kind of come to the fore only recently, it's going to sound surprising when you think about it, is that there is a major difference, sex difference, male-female difference in the incidence of depression. It's almost 2-to-1 biased for females.
So 2-to-1, they're more?
They're more likely to be depressed. And what's very interesting is that a lot of our drugs, of course, are calibrated over the years to 150-pound, 21-year-old males of the undergraduate persuasion. And so, you know, right now there's a lot of focus on kind of individualized medicine, that can we get at ways where we can understand why it is that males and females differ. And they do. You know, even the wiring of the brain is different in men and women. And the response to antidepressant drugs is different. Women tend to respond better to one class than men do, and vice versa. So there's a lot to be learned about kind of how it is different people, particularly people of different sexes, actually are going to be best served by the current methods of treatment are moving forward.
Very interesting. If you have a question, we still have a little time left. 513-772-9658 here in Cincinnati. Again, that's 772-9658. Toll free anywhere in the country, 877-772-9658. Our guest today is Dr. Jim Herman from UC Neuroscience Institute. We've been talking about depression. It's very fascinating, but I want to throw something a little different at you. And I don't know, maybe this is not something in your area of interest or research, but one of the big topics lately is the number of professional athletes who have been suffering from all manner of mental illnesses because of concussions suffered during their playing careers. And maybe can you talk a little bit about, so in this case, I guess it's the concussions cause physical structural damage to the brain, and that's leading to depression and suicides and things like that?
Well, guess what part of the brain gets hit? Yeah. By a head-on collision. It's Area 25 is right there.
Really? Okay.
And so that the so-called prefrontal cortex, right essentially at the frontal pole of the brain, that's going to be kind of the first hit when you are having kind of these head-on collisions. So that's an area of the brain that's particularly traumatized in these cases. And that area of the brain not only controls mood, but it also controls executive, what they call so-called executive function, which includes impulsivity and other emotional outbursts, things along those lines. And so it's really hitting. Not only is it causing damage, but it's causing damage in probably the worst possible place.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just cases, extreme cases, very sad cases like Junior Seau, who committed suicide. Yeah. But there have been quarterbacks I can think of that I won't mention by name who have had erratic behavior during their life. And I've read that some of that erratic behavior could be associated with concussions.
Yes, the notion of impulsivity, that's kind of the ultimate in erratic, causing erratic behavior, and that can be very much a part of kind of those types of disorders. And then, of course, there's always the question whether the erratic behavior led to the concussions also, but
that's true.
That's another story.
And then you look at like Muhammad Ali, who has Parkinson's,
right?
But I guess Parkinson's again, I would think that the Parkinson's probably was, if not caused by, at least worsened by his career.
Oh, of course, yeah. You know, you think about any system. So the brain has a lot of redundancy, and it can handle a little bit of injury and can kind of recover from that. And as I think Bill was mentioning earlier, as things change in the brain as we get older, and we lose some of that reserve capacity that we had earlier on. So, for example, the example of Parkinson's disease, there's an area of the brain called the substantia nigra that is destroyed in the disorder. And in order for you to have full-blown Parkinson's disease, about 80% of those cells have to be gone. Hmm. Now, if you're getting hits and you're knocking off, you know, 3% per hit or something along those lines, you're going to be much more likely to have this disease manifest earlier because you've lost, through the multiple hits, you've lost that resiliency and the ability to acclimate and accommodate.
And your brain can't regenerate. I mean, once it's lost, it's lost? Or
that's a very interesting area of research, kind of the whole notion of neurogenesis.
Right, yeah.
There are new cells being born in the brain all the time, even of people my age. There are new neurons. The question is, how do you get those neurons to the place that they need to go in order to rescue the functions that they need to rescue? And so that's an area of substantial interest right now. We used to think that there's also a good capacity for the brain to reorganize. So, for example, there's evidence in depression that there is an area of the brain called the hippocampus that is smaller in individuals with depression. If those individuals are then given antidepressants and respond to them, their hippocampus goes back to the normal size. Huh. And that's probably due to changes in the structure of the neurons. They get more complex, so they take up more space, and possibly also with the support cells of the nervous system possibly taking over some of the and aiding the functional recovery.
Yeah, that's a whole other program, but it's amazing how, you know, there are people have been shot in the head and how the brain has retaught certain things by, I guess, going through different pathways.
Yes.
Around the damaged area. That's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
So as far as the sports issue, I mean, I guess there's really no way to make a sport perfectly safe. I mean, if the game of football is two teams hitting each other in order to advance the ball, I mean, is there anything as far as, you know, I know this is not your direct area, but as a researcher, is there anything you can do to make sports more safe? Or just don't do it.
I don't know. I don't know how folks would respond to the Super Bowl of flag football.
Right. Right.
But it's not. I mean, I don't think there is a way to make. You can do what you want with the helmets, but it's only going to go so far. If you run into a brick wall with a helmet, it might help you a little bit. But if you keep running into that brick wall with that helmet 100 times, you know, it's going to still take its toll. So it's a tough one.
I understand one of the other areas of interest is post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
And you see this obviously with returning soldiers.
Right.
But also I would imagine, people such as the school shooting in Connecticut where you've experienced or witnessed a very traumatic event.
Right.
How does that affect the brain? Is that affect that one area again, section 25, or is it?
Ironically, it does, okay. And it goes the other way. And so, you know, it's thought that you now have, it's almost like everything in life, in moderation, right? If you have too much, it's not good. If you have too little, it's not good. You just have to have the right amount. And so the thought in this area of the brain is that, in fact, you have a too much inhibition of this region. And so the outflow of this region is very important in informing emotional significance. So if you don't have this outflow, you tend to the parts of the brain that normally mount strong stress fear reactions. This is an area called the amygdala, which is a Latin for almond, which is kind of the shape that neuroanatomists get it. But this area tends to be hyperactive, and so the activity of this region is increased, the activity of the area 25 is decreased. And it's thought that this increase in the amygdala is why the pronounced fear reactions persist, even in the case of kind of innocuous stimuli. And there's interesting research going on now that's doing kind of based on, once again, on basic neuroscience work that is going in and essentially re-exposing, and this is rodents, and there's some clinical trials in humans also, re-exposing individuals to stimuli that are associated with the thing that evokes their stress reaction. But they're doing it under the influence of beta blockers, which inhibit kind of the autonomic heart rate, blood pressure, kind of the fight or flight response that you get with these types of things. So by re-remembering the innocuous stimulus and not being allowed to mount that big response, it's having some success in reducing the symptomology.
Hmm. This is all, I'm sure, relatively new.
Yes.
You know, at one time it's all, get back in the game, you know, you witness something, it's all emotional. But, I mean, there is something physically going on.
And, yeah.
Wow. I have a bunch of other questions, but we're out of time almost. Is there a website where people can go to
yes.
if they want more information about?
Yeah, sure. So the if you're interested in information on UCNI, you should go to www.uchealth.com. And there's also a toll-free number, 866-941-8264 or 866-941-UCNI.
Okay.
And once again, the website is www.uchealth.com. And that will direct you to the clinical programs, to some of the research programs, and it will also get you connected with our network in a few weeks once we get the website up and up and running.
All right, sounds good. And
great.
We have about a minute left. So when you go back to work today, what what exciting things do you see? Is there one particular area of research that you'd say that's wow? I look forward to looking at this more closely.
I think the thing that really is fascinating to me is the whole notion of early life events. And one of the things that we have an active research program ongoing now, and I actually just finished being stressed and writing a NIH grant to support this, but it's looking at how traumas in adolescent life actually change the physical structure of the brain and cause long-lasting changes in mood, for example, depression later in life. And we have some very cool evidence recently showing that the actual physical structure of the brain in terms of how it is area 25, this is in the rat now, it's equivalent,
right.
and the amygdala are talking to each other is actually altered. So that's what we're currently studying, and that's what I think is going to be give us some good insight into the pathologies and how they develop.
Very interesting, and that's how Children's is working with UC
yes.
on this.
Yeah.
Very good. Dr. James P. Herm is Director of the Network of Neuroscience and Senior Researcher at UC's Neuroscience Institute. Thank you so much. This was
a lot
of fun and very,
appreciate
very
it.
Interesting. And again, if folks, we'll have this website up at the front desk if you want to get more information. And again, thanks to everyone who called in today, and we'll be back again next week with more on HealthScope.
You've been listening to WMKV HealthScope. Join us again next Monday at 1 p.m. for another edition of WMKV HealthScope on 89.3 WMKV Reading, Ohio.